Good day and welcome to episode 16 of the Breezy Breakfast Radio Hour. I'm James Gordon, and I'm part of the team behind a weekly community gathering focused on raising awareness and sharing ideas about important issues that concern residents of Guelph and beyond. This week, a bit of a departure. About once a month, we hold an open mic session where we don't have an assigned guest or topic, but rather let our regular attendees on Zoom, of whom we have close to 200 now, have their say and introduce topics that they are concerned about. This episode is distilled from our conversation at the end of September 2020. For your interest, our moderator Dustin Brown and Councillor Phil Ault give an overview of some of the issues that have been on our collective minds of late. Then we dive into issues as diverse as the Parkview Motel, where there is a proposal from our local drop-in center to convert this building into permanent supportive housing, which organically led to a chat about our citywide housing crisis, then into some comments about overnight parking, and lastly, staffing issues with our local mobility buses. A real civic smorgasbord. I chip in here now and then, as do quite a few of our breezy participants who get introduced by name by Dustin, who starts things off right now.
Now, I'm just going to open this open mic session with a short list of things that I think will be talked about. Firstly, let's just do a short recap of what we have gone through meeting-wise since the last open mic. And by my records, it's been a month and a half, a little bit over a month and a half since we've had an open mic session, which would have been on July 24th. Sorry, I'm just seeing notifications in the chat. So since then, our guests have been first myself, representing the Guelph Renters Union and Housing Advocates. That was at the outset when it was a day before or 2 days before the eviction ban was lifted. And since then, eviction proceedings have begun. They're starting to be processed online as of August 20th. So something that is very invulnerable to protest and disruption, and lots of people in Guelph and other places in Ontario are now facing impending or have already faced eviction. So that's an ongoing thing that could be talked about. We also had a panel on prosperity and austerity in relation to the awkward proposal to have 0% budget increase to the municipal budget. The week after that, we had our panel hosted by Sequoia Kim on online learning. And then subsequent weeks, we talked about the Guelph Museums and the Guelph Black Heritage Society. We talked about childcare in the pandemic and otherwise. And then last week, we went over the council composition review with the city clerk and Kevin Bowman from Democracy Guelph. So that already, maybe there are some updates that we want on those. We have the council approved electric buses. We have the motion on winter overnight parking. We have the Parkview Motel, which I'm sure will generate a lot of discussion. We have the Earl Emma Street Bridge, and a lot more that I'm sure people will want to bring up. So please go ahead and bring things up in the chat if you would like to.
With regards to that, we did have a council, committee of the whole meeting on Tuesday, at which a couple of important issues were discussed. And one of them will be coming up, and I won't preclude it. That was the Emma Earl Bridge that I do think does need to be, no pun intended, deconstructed a little bit, because from my point of view, there were some serious procedural issues in what we were dealing with there that we need to get a handle on so that we don't constantly repeat these. The other one was our tree canopy issue, the operations campus. Yes, a multi-million dollar proposal that is starting off with the electrification of buses, but which is going to be a financial challenge for us as well. Council, again, having made one decision, which we can reconsider at some point and just might. And must also be compared and contrasted with both the financing of the library and the South End Rec Center. These are all issues that came up last week, which I think are certainly worthy of discussion. And I think that we can leave it to Dustin to bring all of the issues up that he's got in front of him at this point.
Absolutely. So I think it makes sense to me to start with the most controversial. And how do you gauge that? Well, I'm just going to say it. It's the Parkview Motel, I'm going to say, because we already talked about it for about 20 minutes before the meeting even opened. So I know people have a lot to say about it. And I'm going to start off with Juanita, who requested in chat to talk about this.
Hey, everybody. I love the idea of dedicated supportive housing, but I hate that it looks like it's robbing Peter to pay Paul, kind of, that in order to have one service for the same group of people, they have to stop the previous service that did a whole lot of good. So I don't know if talks have been in place with Royal City Mission maybe, or Hope House or other places where similar programs have happened. And I guess the other concern I have around Parkview is it will be enough to support the people that are currently being supported. And I don't know how many other people aren't. So yeah, that's it for me for now.
Okay. So James, looks like you can speak to that. I want to maybe introduce it a little bit more. So what I've been hearing rumor of is that the purchase and you know, new accommodation at the Parkview Motel would potentially come at expense of closing the drop-in center. Is that a substantiated claim, or what do we know about that?
Thanks, Dustin, and I'll preface it by answering Lynn and Ron's question. Where is the Parkview Motel? It is right across from the cemetery on Maryland Drive, the corner of Woolwich and Maryland. It's called the Parkview Motel because you can see Riverside Park from it. But to address both your points there, I think it's still a rumor that it's an either or situation in terms of what Juanita was saying to whether to open that permanent supportive housing project it would be purchased by the drop-in center. It means that they wouldn't fulfill the current role that they have at the Welcome Center. My understanding, and we'll clarify that, I'll end this by inviting people to our town hall meeting about it next week. But the current operations during COVID of the drop-in center were kind of combined with what other agencies were doing, mostly for labor efficiency. And I'm not sure that that's meant to be a permanent thing. Has anyone heard more than I have about that? Because there has been a lot of talk about that. And Juanita, you're quite correct. People are worried. Well, does that eliminate citizens that are even more vulnerable than those that would be housed at the Parkview? But I need clarification about that. And I'm not sure that that's correct at this point.
James, I'm going to leap in on that one because I think that there has been a tremendous amount of anxiety about what the Parkview Motel proposal might mean in all sorts of different ways. And that we need to be careful of. We don't know. There's been more questions than answered. And a lot of it is really in the realm of speculation. And this has been part of the problem. My problem with actually this whole issue and the failure of process and honestly, you know, James, you're taking a hammering on this and you clearly admit that. Part of that is because of a failed process, because the principle of finding a permanent supportive housing location is one that can easily be embraced. But we as a council were gobsmacked by this, and the community was also gobsmacked. And this has led to a number of problems that might actually mean that this particular proposal will not see the light of day as a consequence of far too many factors not yet having been addressed, including community engagement, which has apparently been thrown on your shoulders, which really, in my mind, should be thrown on the shoulders of Gail Hoekstra, Cam Guthrie, and the mover of that motion, Mike Salisbury. It's just a coincidence that it's in your ward, and yet you're the one that's taking the heat.
Well, before we go to Morgan, I'll respond to that and catch people up here about that, what you're talking about, the process. What should have happened, which didn't, was that the drop-in center is, in effect, acting as a developer in this case. It is the responsibility of a developer to apprise neighbors and other stakeholders about the nature of their project before it comes to council. This, in my view, it wasn't a deliberate ploy by the drop-in center. It was an accidental chain of events. Gail Hoekstra was speaking to the St. Joe's housing issue when she mentioned what her project was. Councillor Salisbury said, oh, that sounds fantastic. And he got a motion passed to investigate what supports we could give to that project. So all of a sudden it was out in the open, but before neighbors knew about it, before you and I knew about it, which is unfortunate, because I'm not sure if you agree with me, Phil, but the project certainly has merit. Because it came a bit out of the blue, the neighbors are incensed, but I'm not sure. I think they still would have been just incensed if it had gone through the proper processes. And watch out, there's a rant alert here. I have never in my 6 years on council seen a more blatantly NIMBY response to this. And the tone of what I'm hearing from those neighbors, that's a side issue as to how the process started. What's really apparent is that our culture is get to a place where there's very little empathy. There's little view amongst neighbors that, you know, where did love thy neighbor go to? Almost all the responses are, I'm not NIMBY, but there's a lovely empty lot way out in the industrial area. Let's throw them there. And it's always, as I think it was someone else mentioned, it's always them. It's always those people. And I can speak, I won't speak about it at length now, but you would be so shocked if you heard the tone of the conversations I've been having with people. Just one example, last night, a woman emailed me and hoped that they would put a large fence completely around the motel so that the neighbors didn't have to look at homeless people. It's that bad.
It is bad. And unfortunately, what we didn't do, and this is why I say that process was violated in a way that has really soured a neighborhood. We could probably have worked and developed some empathy and some support for a principle that actually, I'm going to be quite blunt here, could have improved what is, for all intents and purposes, a derelict motel. And could have been turned into something really, really positive that could have enhanced supportive housing. On the other hand, because of the process issue, just like with tiny houses, we threw something into a neighborhood without any framework in order that would have provided us with an opportunity of having worked with people on this. And that's the disappointment on this. And James, I think you're entirely correct. We have gone, pun intended, from we to me very, very quickly in Guelph. And I think that it's expressing something that is very current in Ontario culture right now.
This is Ted, just a comment. I put something in chat about the location for the benefit of homeless people. If I was homeless, I couldn't think of a better place to have a chance to be. This is in my backyard. It's 6 minutes away walking. Not my walking, because I'm walking really slowly these days, but an average person walking. I don't live across the road. I know the big concern is my property values are going to go down. If this motel is maintained by the agency that is looking after it, it will probably be something that the rest of the community can be proud of. We are running out of places to put homeless in Guelph because nobody wants them there. This is a place where homeless people would like to be. It's near a park, it's near shopping, it's near fast food. You can walk to the downtown through parks. It's a brilliant location for homeless.
Thank you, Ted. I really hope you come to the town hall and express that, because that's a rare view and it actually is a great location. It's right on the 99 bus route. The headquarters of the CMHA are going in less than 100 yards from there. So, and there'll be, to clarify for people who are asking, it is, I see in the chat, it is currently is a homeless shelter since COVID started. The drop-in center has been placing clients there, but also they have been placing clients there since they started in 1986. So, but it's pretty transient in nature, and the hotel is still open to anyone that wants to rent a room. And so the neighbors have a justification for their fears when they've seen activity there that scares them. However, they're not willing to listen to the opportunity for permanent supportive housing that would change that picture. I have a lot of statistics now about how projects like this can increase property values. They never decrease them. And once I've been saying to people, as permanent supportive housing, when people say, I don't want homeless people in my neighborhood, as soon as you give someone a key to that room, which is theirs, they're no longer homeless. That's right. Okay. Stop me, Dustin. I'll rant all morning. Keep going.
I'm waiting to hear from Morgan, who's been in the queue for a while.
Yeah, so I can't remember exactly where I saw it, whether it was on Caremongering, one of my many Facebook groups that I belong to that have to do with social justice and caring and everything like that. There was a repost of something from Royal City Mission stating unequivocally that the drop-in is not going to be open for any types of meals. And I don't recall hearing anything about length of time for that. They have put together a schedule with Hope House, whereby Hope House and Royal City Mission will be serving three meals per day, Monday through Saturday. And there is no meal service, period, on Sundays. So based on that post, my thought is for the foreseeable future, at least until the end of 2020, the calendar year, there is not going to be any activity physically at the drop-in in the form that Sister Christine put it together. So I have a big concern. I know most of us here know who what the bench is, and a lot of us do support that. And that is something that Ed Pickersgill is really, really concerned about, the fact that Sister Christine's model of caring is being usurped. And I agree with Juanita, there is still a need for at somewhere safe for people that are not necessarily homeless, but those people that are socially isolated. They don't have a lot of friends. There's nowhere for them to go, or they have a room in a house somewhere. They're not technically homeless, but they have nowhere to gather with friends. And the drop-in was not only a huge place for people to go, but it was an amazing place for people to create their own community. So if the Royal City Mission and Hope House are stepping in and working together to take that up And there's going to be the opportunity for more volunteerism within those organizations to step in and fill in the gaps that will happen because the drop-in's no longer there. That would be great. As far as the Parkview Motel itself, I would really like to see us change the narrative and the title from supported or Parkview Motel and homeless to something along the lines of supporting housing project at Woolwich and Marilyn. Because by using the words that we're using, it is creating some of the issue. The point that Phil or that James has made is as soon as someone has somewhere to live, they're no longer homeless. I don't know how many of us on this call have actually been in that state where you are homeless, but I have. I've couch surfed for months and not known whether I'm going to be able to put food in my stomach. I know what it's like to have to live with nothing and depend on your friends. And where I lived, I didn't have the things like the drop-in where I could go. And if I had had that, it would have probably been a lot better for me. So I really hope that there's some way that we can continue to provide those services because they are absolutely crucial.
Agreed. I know the mayor likes to talk about support for a housing first policy, but if it's a just housing policy, then that's almost equally problematic because that still leaves a lot of service gaps. Now, I'm being conscious of time and we don't want to spend all of our meeting on this issue, but I do want to hear from Kate and then Phil and then Brian, and then we'll move on to overnight parking. So Kate, you're up.
Thank you. I just wanted to thank Ted for what he said, because I thought that was really beautiful and a really nice example of community coming together. And that's not something that we've been seeing a lot of with this motel proposal. So I just wanted to like say how sweet that was and say thank you. My thing is we've been seeing nothing's going to be perfect with this, right? Like there's always going to be, well, it should be permanent housing. Oh, it should be this. But we don't really have time again because here we are, we're in September again. And we still don't have like a concrete plan for how it's going to go for people who are unhoused this winter. And it seems like every year we're having the same conversation. Like this is the third year we're talking. I like have been involved in community discussions about it, and we still don't really have a concrete plan. And it's still all up in the air at this point. And that just to me is so frustrating because I look at these condos and they go up with no problem and they go up quickly and that's never an issue at hand. But then when we have this development here, or sorry, like this proposal here, there's all these issues and there's all these, not only is it difficult from a community level with NIMBYs, but it's difficult from like a municipal politics level. And I'm just not understanding how, like, I just think our priorities are really messed up because I don't understand it at all. And it's really frustrating to watch again. And like, of course it's not going to be perfect, but we don't have time anymore to have this perfect plan. We have to get people off the streets because people are dying being on the streets. It's actually like, it's ridiculous that we're having this conversation again. And I just think there's no excuse. So thanks for listening to me, Rand. It's just really frustrating to watch.
Yeah. Thank you. Kate, if I could briefly comment on that, and I appreciate your comments, and going back to something Morgan said too, the Drop-In Center is an independent nonprofit charity. It's not our collective job to tell them what their priorities should be. If we have a civic responsibility, is to learn where the gaps are. So if that's where they want to focus their energies, we have to notice what's missing, as you've alluded to. Are they dropping the ball, so to speak, or is there a gap in the kind of service offered at the current Gordon Street drop-in center? And that's where we need to step in and say, what can we do with that? But I can't see a scenario where we'd say, drop-in center, we don't like what you're doing, do something else.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on quickly to Phil, if you have more to add.
Yeah, Kate, I'm tremendously sympathetic with your comments. And one of the things that I would encourage you, Edward Pickersgill, Royal City Mission, Gail Hoekstra, everyone concerned with this do, please, and I urge you to do it quickly, is to organize so that the city actually establishes an effective contingency program that can be implemented so that we don't constantly repeat this Groundhog Day style. You're quite correct. And, you know, the problems that I see this as a result of failure are legion. First of all, James is quite correct. The drop-in center is operating as a developer. And as a consequence of that, the precedent being set is that developers can also make the argument that they can jump the queue. And that's a really important issue, because you pointed out that condos and so on seem to go up holus bolus. We must sustain the principles that neighborhoods must be engaged. And sometimes we don't like that, but that principle is incredibly important. We saw the problem when neighborhoods were not engaged on the Metrolinx GO Transit issues. That's imperative, that we engage neighbors in municipal democracy always. And that's my fear, is if we have somebody who believes they have a friend in Queen's Park who can just drop a ministerial zoning order, this is fraught with peril. So let's make certain that we do the issue right, and do those that can be served by this right, by making certain that we get ahead of it in time enough that we're effective.
Okay, and last in this queue here is Brian Holstein. And I see Bill Hewlett, you might have something to say about it too.
Hi, a couple of things. I have no problems with the idea at all. It's the process again. But with the NIMBY people, it's always happened and it will continue to happen. When Sister Christine, for those of you who remember, was on right downtown, I believe it was Wimpy's, who had complaint after complaint about them being there. If there was something on the street, it was Christine's fault. If there was a problem on the street, it was Christine's fault. Get them out of here. When this happens, when the motel is opened up, the same thing's going to happen unless people are convinced otherwise that we're dealing with homeless people here and not some breed of mutant, because if there's any problem on the street, it'll be from those people. If somebody drops a coffee cup on the street, it's going to be those people. If raccoons get into my garbage, it wasn't raccoons. It must have been those people who did it. So it's going to be a long journey, A, to get this happening, and B, to convince people that it was a good thing, and you're dealing with people here, not those people. Thanks.
Good. Thank you, Brian. Bill, you have the last word on the Parkview Motel if you want it. There you are.
I just wanted to, I think it was Kate mentioned that it's easy to get condos built in this town versus this sort of thing. It's not easy to get condos or any type of housing built in this town. And I'm not very popular when I say this, but housing, a big part of the problem with housing in the city is that we're not building enough of it, and we're not building enough of it because of any type, including condos. And that's because people don't want high density housing in their neighborhoods. And housing isn't something that just affects poor people. A lack of housing is a cause of poverty. You can have the greatest social network in the world, and if housing is really expensive, you just nullified all those other social programs. And we're not going to get affordable housing unless we allow developers to build the amount of housing that's necessary for the population and the population growth. And council, that's a fundamental problem that underlies everything else. And I think it's really important to follow Henry David Thoreau's dictum that for every person chopping at the root of a problem, there's 1,000 chopping at the branches and leaves. So I really think it's important that we all take some time and ask ourselves, why is it so damned hard to build apartment buildings in this town? And I think there's very few people in this city who don't have their thumb in that pie. That's all I want to say.
Well, I think that I can call that a different topic, actually, if anybody wants to comment on that. I'll say that's something I've noticed as well in my 4 years at Guelph. I haven't really seen too many apartment buildings go up. I want to balance that, I guess, with a brief analysis on, you know, how rare it is that housing cost actually goes down in a capitalist system, whether or not supply is added. I don't think things will go down. I think they'll just, they'll increase more slowly. So I'm concerned that maybe we're past the tipping point in terms of housing being on the whole unaffordable for the lower working class.
Hi, this is Lynn Grist. I'd like to say something short. Okay. I actually agree with William. We do not have enough housing. And you're right, people don't like intensification. But there is a caveat to that. Every time we build something new, we as the residents of Guelph get to pay around 25 cents on every dollar of infrastructure. So when we start building, we have to think about what that's going to do to the tax base, okay? And that's really important. So when we choose taxes, when we choose places, we need to think about what it's going to actually cost the residents. And nobody seems to mention that. You know, it's really interesting to me. You know, like, why not? Why would we not talk about that? You know, development charges, I realize, are boring and drive people to absolutely crazy, but they're really important. They're a really important part of our budget. Anyway, I just want to say that in passing. It's not that I disagree with William, but I think we need to be careful about how we develop, because if we're spending money on developing housing, we're not spending it on condos, for example, on, you know, high cost condos down in the South End. We're not spending it on the library or something else. So, you know, it's not a simple, oh, I don't like housing, or, oh, I do like housing. Okay, that's all. Thanks.
Thank you, Lynn. So we'll move on to Tanya.
Yeah, I just wanted to say something. There is a have your say with regards to how and where should Guelph grow. It's online until September 24th, and there will be a town hall on September 17th from 7 to 8 p.m. So you can talk about these things online and at the town hall. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Tanya. And Bill, you're back.
Yeah. I just said what I said, and for what it's worth. I mean, everyone has their opinion about this, but I do think that there is something to the supply and demand argument, is that if you don't have as much housing being built as people want, the price is always going to go high, and developers will always build for the carriage trade instead of low-income people. Most people I know who live in low-cost housing, and that was me, lived in old rundown apartments. And those actually were cheaper. The supply of rundown apartments and houses has disappeared in Guelph because people complain about gentrification. Well, gentrification is a result of not having an adequate housing supply. I did it myself. I bought a crappy rundown student house and rebuilt it because that's what I could afford. And it all comes down, some of it is just a supply issue. You've just got to jam more housing into a community. And for years and years, Guelph has been one of the fastest growing cities in Guelph population-wise. But the people who already own their homes have fought tooth and nail against intensification. And that has had lots of spillover effects. And one of them is the decline of the pool of crappy low-cost apartments and houses in the city. And that's where a lot of these poor people who are homeless now used to live. I mean, people really want to tie themselves up in knots and not say that they're not wanting an apartment building in their back that they can see from their home is the reason why there are homeless people on the street. But to a certain extent, that's exactly why we have homeless people on the streets. And everything else is just self-justification.
Okay, if I can just tack on to that a little bit. I moved to Guelph 20 years ago. I bought what was considered a high-end condo at that point. It had linoleum floors. It had arborite countertops. I have upgraded all of those sorts of things to granite and wood floors and all of those kinds of things. So I've done exactly the same thing. I've gentrified what was probably, and not necessarily entry level, but it was considered a really nice condo. I paid $185,000 for it. It's now worth $550,000 on the market. That's over 20 years. And that's what the Guelph market has done with buildings that are 30 years old. I know that if somebody wanted to put a high rise on my property, because there is actually room to put a high rise unit and underground parking and all of those kinds of things, that there'd be a big protest within the 76 units that live here who do not want a high rise. We're all townhouses and or chalet style buildings, and that's how we want it to stay. It's totally unfair, realistically, when we do need places where we can diversify the housing. And the downtown is worse than not in my backyard. We have all kinds of really large homes where the families have moved on. There's two people or one person inside. It could become easily a rooming house that would house up to 10 people. That's what happened in Toronto. But those rooming houses are now becoming gentrified and families are moving back in, which is why Toronto has an even bigger problem than Guelph with its homeless. That's just to tack on to Bill.
Susan Ratcliffe, you have the last word on intensity.
there's a number of issues that have not been mentioned in this intensification. I grew up in four of us and my parents in a 700 square foot house, as did many people of my generation. We lived in the so-called suburbs in Toronto. My dad bought the house for $4,000 and fixed it up. It was never bigger than 700 square feet. I was walking around the old university neighborhood yesterday, and those little houses are being torn down, not to be replaced by larger, by apartments or multiple housing, but by monster houses. If you look at the stats, the average size of houses now is 2,500 square feet. So it's not the problem of the downtown, it's the problem of people tearing down affordable little houses that were suitable, say, in the old days, and don't say okay boomer to me, but to build these huge places. So what council is allowing is the demolition of houses that were suitable and affordable to allow for the monster houses, the McMansions, that then force out those affordable housing. So when you're looking at a housing policy, and you can talk to Leanne Piper, you don't need a 20-story building to intensify. 6 to 8 stories will do the job perfectly well. We need to look at size of buildings and keep those little houses, the 700 square foot, the wartime houses, and not allow them to be demolished for McMansions and super houses and whatever you want to call them. So there's that other issue to add to the whole. It's not a matter of building apartments. It's a matter of diversity of housing and keeping them small enough. And also, to add another issue, to stop people coming here to commute to Toronto. That's all I have to say.
Okay, thank you, Susan. So let's move on to something else that's contentious that I know we want to talk about. Brian Holstein, you wanted to talk about overnight parking.
Sure. Didn't know I'd be starting this off, but I was again concerned when I heard that this proposal came up. Why? I can only guess, but they will stay with me. Right now, when we have parking, people do park on the street overnight, the owners. But that's mainly because of convenience, so that Betty doesn't have to get up to let Fred out of the driveway. So let's park on the street. There's room for the car right now. When the winter comes, okay, we just have to go in and Betty, sorry, you've got to move the car so Fred can get out. With this taken away and overnight parking being allowed during the winter, there's no need to make sure that there is that space for the car. You don't need it. I can park on the street. And that's fine. But when a phone call or whatever is received to say you have to move your car, we're going to plow the street, where the hell am I going? Where's Betty going to put that car or whoever? There's going to be no place. What, are they going to park it down the street where they can't? Already, even in our neighborhood, we have a few landlords who have decided to enhance their properties right beside their driveways with ever-increasingly wide walkways on which cars now are permitted to park. They can only do this to a certain extent. Unfortunately, many people don't buy for their needs, they buy for their wants. If they can park on the street, we can buy that SUV, we can buy that bloody Jeep or whatever else, and I don't have to worry about a parking spot until the city gives a call and says, we're plowing the street, you'll have to move it. And the person's going to say, well, where? That's not fair. It is, but anyway.
For those who don't know or weren't able to read between the lines, we're talking about Councillor Gawler's motion to permit overnight parking during the wintertime. Even though there are a slew of problems that could come up with when the roads need to be plowed, Councillor Gawler contends that it's not actually too often in the wintertime that the plows are deployed, and we have the technology to notify people if they need to move their cars off the street. Yeah, and I'll say, yeah, relating to what you were bringing up, we're in a house that's been divided into four different units, and we have one single strip driveway. So there are six drivers, all from, you know, different units of this this building who need to use that single strip. So it gets really annoying, I'll say, when people need to leave and, you know, the group chat's exploding with, you know, where's Jim, where's Carol? I need them to get their car out of the driveway. So I could see this helping somewhat in that scenario, but also I know there are lots of arguments against. So what do we have? We have Morgan and then James, Morgan, then Phil, then James.
Actually, I would like to wait to hear what Phil and James have to say, because they may end up answering my question.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Phil, you're up first.
Okay, thanks, Dustin. And Brian, blame me for putting you on the spot, but I think that spot was very important. I think I'll be quite blunt. I will not be supporting Councillor Gawler's motion. I think it's absolutely nuts. And there are a number of different reasons for that. You've alluded to winter parking, but there are other factors as well. I live on a street that has 365, 7 days a week parking. And I can identify some of the difficulties that we currently have. First of all, in terms of structural issues, we do not have enough bylaw staff to enforce a 365, 7 day a week parking issue throughout the city. Rather than doing what Councillor Gawler is suggesting, and I've talked to our CAO about this, the city needs to engage in a comprehensive parking strategy study. And we need to examine what the needs are and what the solutions are. My approach to this is fairly simple. We need to examine what the model is in a place like inner city Montreal or Quebec, where this is done quite well, but has some certain caveats and requirements on it. One of which is that parked cars cannot remain on the same side of the street or in the same spot too long, and parking is enforced quite rigorously. The other issue is to examine what a residential needs and what our commuter needs as well. It might be that we should be going to a permit parking system for everybody, and that would provide a limited number of parking permits for each household, and then people that are not part of a household that need parking might be required to purchase one. It also, as I said, requires us to actually spend some money on those who might enforce this. But it also begs a question, and Dustin, you alluded to that, and that is, you've got six cars in your household. One of the very simple reasons for that is an inadequate transit system. And as a consequence of us trying to avoid spending money on improving transit, we're looking for a simple solution, which is to bring more cars into the mix, which to my mind is actually running completely counter to progress. We should be reducing the number of cars on the streets. We should be confining streets so that they're actually narrower, and we should be examining urban planning. So I don't know what Councillor Gawler is trying to solve, but I suspect that James is probably going to go into a rant on the number of people that use their garages as storage areas and then are parking three and four vehicles on the street, who then feel that somehow their right to park on the street has been impugned. This is far too premature and needs to have an honest assessment of what we need within the community. I don't know who got to Gawler, but he's not getting my support.
I'll briefly comment on that, Dustin, because I have to run. And thanks. Yeah, that was a good summary of a rant that I don't have to give now, Phil. the reason I cannot support the motion is because it's not, there is no one size fits all solution. When you said who got to Gawler, there's actually a neighborhood in our ward that we affectionately call Camelot because of Arthur Street, King Street, and Queen Street. A lot of that neighborhood and some of the older areas, including yours, Phil, people don't have driveways, so they get stuck, especially when that changes at the end of October. So there probably are solutions to look at for that, but it doesn't fit the whole city. And you're absolutely correct. I was very naive when I was first elected to council, still am, I guess, thinking, okay, our priority needs to be getting people out of their cars. And as you alluded to, we cannot do that until we have a robust improvement in our transit. So we can't tell Fred and Betty and Jim and Carol, which is a great movie, by the way, we can't tell them to not have that many cars if we can't offer them an alternative. However, the kind of motion that Gawler is suggesting to me just invites more cars, and that is very counterproductive right now. So we have to work our way slowly, I guess. I wish it was not such baby steps, but there are a lot of reasons why this won't work for me. And sorry, guys, I have to go. Thanks.
Hey, bye, James.
And I did kind of get my questions answered. I came to Guelph from Milton, and when I moved to Milton, there was still pretty close to just the 30,000 people there because I got in early in the 2000s. So I really saw a growing city struggling with parking. Most of Milton at that point in time was being built out by Mattamy, and just like the majority of the subdivisions that we see here in Guelph where Mattamy is involved, the streets are not wide enough to park on both sides. Usually there's only sidewalk on one side of the street, and where you've got these McMansions that Susan was talking about, where you've got the basements being rented out to low-income people, like Phil was stating in the chat, where you've got, you know, 7-8 people living in one house and there's multiple adults, like you've got in Dustin's situation, having people park on the street without consequence is not a good solution. Anybody that travels around down in the ward in the wintertime, especially if you're traveling on Alice, Morris, Johnson, Harris, there's times where cars are parked on both sides of the street. The snowbanks are so much that you can barely snake your way through in a car. So to have it be permissible to always be parked on the road and have it be the city's responsibility to notify people and to have people actually pay attention, listen, and actually move their cars somewhere, I don't see how this can work. I think it needs to be scrapped, and we need to wait to be informed by the studies that are happening right now as to what has to happen in the city, not some ad hoc motion in advance of a report that's been in the works for a while. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Morgan. Now, Brian, you requested to close us off on this, so you have a 10-second bit. There you go.
Okay, not to close it off, but I like James's description of that area as of Camelot, because it must indeed be magical, because when people went there to buy, they bought, and then suddenly the veil was lifted from their eyes and there was no driveway. And I mean, that's awful, terrible magic that happens in Camelot. So if you buy a house with no chimney, don't start complaining that you don't have a chimney. If you buy a house with a poor front door, that's your problem. Anyway, I couldn't resist that.
Good. Now, Elaine, right off the top of the hour, you asked to talk about mobility in this city. Would you like to?
Okay. Yeah. That's what I'm using right now, and it's not. They just cut 17 drivers, so one of the bus drivers went on mobility. He actually picked me up yesterday. He had no training, and it was unbelievable what went on in that bus mobility. And I cannot believe it. He didn't know how to hook up a walker. And then when he picked me up later in the day, he says, I had a wheelchair. You should have saw the fun I had with that. I didn't even know what to do. And I thought, they told him he didn't need any training. I could see he wasn't doing, he didn't do up the seat belts, blah, 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 blah. And my appointment was 3:00. I had to leave here at 1:00. I had to sit in a coffee place for an hour before my appointment, because this is what has happened to our mobility and buses, because they cut the 17 drivers. So it's not a good thing. And to put the driver that drives the city buses into a mobility and not give them any training, I couldn't believe my eyes what I saw yesterday. And it's no fun. And then same with them picking me up. They couldn't pick me up at 3:30. I had to wait longer, too. So this is what's happening with our lovely bus system.
So, Elaine, just to clarify, maybe Phil, you can jump in on this too. The 17 drivers that were cut, were those just for the mobility buses?
No. Oh, no. That was 17 from the both areas. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just cut this week.
Elaine, if you wish, give me a call. Because I'm happy to forward your concerns on. It is an important issue that you're identifying. And just a few fun and not such fun facts about this. Our mobility drivers do require, I would have to say, more patience and some training that they don't necessarily get. The other issue is that they are paid less than our regular drivers. I will give our transit commission credit for trying to find ways to redesignate staff at a time when we are really strapped as a consequence of COVID on this particular issue. Partially the problem lies with the fact that we have this incredible ratio of funding for transit that requires people to
requires riders to essentially underwrite about 60%, 50 to 60% of transit. It doesn't really matter what the number is. And so when ridership goes down, we then have a problem of an underfunded system.
Yeah.
But your particular case is very important. So if you could email me or phone me some details so that I can pass them on to Robin Jarris, that would be very, very helpful. And I don't have any good news for you. It ain't going to get better.
No, I know it's going to get worse.
Probably going to get worse.
and to get bookings too. Yeah, sometimes you just have
a booking. And that's a chronic problem. To be fair to the transit system, they are trying to work on that. We have probably one of the most regressive mobility transit systems, I would think, anywhere in the world. It makes no sense to me that you have to wait the hours that you do for mobility.
Ran out of time again, that's all. Thanks as always to our guests and to the Breezy Breakfast team of Phil Alt, Dustin Brown, Tanya Gavert, Hina Mystery, Sequoia Kim, and our many supporters who gather every Thursday at the unkind hour of 8 a.m. Music for the Breezy Breakfast Radio Hour is by Jules Germ. If you'd like to join us in one of our live Zoom sessions or you have any questions, email me, James Gordon, at james@jamesgordon.ca. If you'd like to support the work that we do on this program, please visit patreon.com and look for Breezy Bullhorn. Thank you for any support you can lend, and as always, for listening.